This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
And in the desert specifically, I mean, there's all sorts of battles over all energy sources when you get into conflict with land use and national parks and preserves and just ecosystems in general. I mean, I've written all sorts of stories about environmental opposition to solar projects and wind projects and, you know, things that you would think that all environmentalists would support, just because when you get into actually putting things on the ground and grading natural land, mining groundwater, you get into really tricky conversations. And many of those conversations are divisive even amongst environmentalists.
As more and more of the western United States suffers from warmer temperatures and in some places desertification, water has become perhaps the most hotly debated topic in environmental newsrooms throughout the region. It's no surprise then that an environmental reporter from the Palm Springs-based Desert Sun would be covering a whole host of water-related stories. This week on Sea Change Radio, we take a deep dive into a pool of topics with Sammy Roth that hopefully won't dampen your spirits. First, we break down a noteworthy case involving one wealthy farmer's crusade against his local water district. Then we turn to the controversy surrounding two proposed hydropower facilities. And last, we take a look at a company that's causing a stir by trying to sell desert groundwater to urban areas. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Sammy Roth. Sammy is a reporter for the Desert Sun. Sammy, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
It's good to be here, Alex.
I love to have you on. You do excellent work. And while many people around the country may not read the Desert Sun, a lot of the work that you do pertains to a vast swath of the country. Last time you came on, we talked a little bit about the Imperial Irrigation District and a lawsuit that was involving the Colorado River water flow. Maybe you can kind of give us a background on this and update us on it. So you did an interesting profile on Mike Abadi, who's a pretty interesting character in your region.
Sure. So the Colorado River issue here is that the Imperial Irrigation District, as I've mentioned, I've been on in the past, they have the biggest single allocation of water from the Colorado River. So the Colorado River is shared by seven states in Mexico. It provides drinking water for, you know, drinking water or irrigation water for like 40 million people and a lot of farmland and a whole lot of big cities like Los Angeles, Vegas, Phoenix, et cetera. And the Imperial Irrigation District, this farm water provider in the desert in California, has an allocation of 3.1 million acre feet out of the like 15 million total acre feet that are allocated in the United States. That's like a fifth of the whole U.S. side of the rivers is in the hands of the IID. So they're a big deal. And, you know, you've got these regional efforts going on to try to use less water from the river and leave more water in one of the big reservoirs, Lake Mead, to, put off having a shortage at Lake Mead. So IID is a big part of that because they have so much water. The issue that I've been writing about recently is this lawsuit from one of the farmers that's served by the IID, a guy named Mike Abadi. He's a former board member of the IID. He's a pretty powerful figure in the Imperial Valley. And I've written about him a lot because he's done a lot of business with this energy consulting group, Z Global, on solar projects. And Z Global has raised all these issues have been raised with Z Global, you know, allegedly having conflicts of interest because it was also working for the IID and building projects to connect to the IID. And anyway, Mike Abadi was involved in all of that. But the Colorado River point is that he sued the IID to try to invalidate this thing that IID had called the Equitable Distribution Plan, which is basically a fancy way of the IID saying, if there's ever a shortage on the river that we need to deal with, if we get more Well, really what it is if we get more requests for water from farmers than there is water available in a given year, how are we going to deal with that? How are we going to cut back? Who's going to get how much? Who's going to get less than they asked for? And the body challenged the way that IID had proposed to do that. He said that he thought it was going to be unfair to farmers who had historically used a lot more water, like him. He says his fields, because of the soil composition and things of that nature, require more water. And he thought it was going to be unfair to him. And to the surprise of a lot of people, he won this lawsuit at the trial court. The judge issued a really sweeping ruling in favor of him that not only said, yes, the way the IID has done this is unfair and illegal and is going to harm farmers like you, and they need to do it the way that you've said they ought to do it. This judge, Brooks Anderholt, also had a lot of language in his ruling that sort of seemed to undermine the idea that IID is really in charge of this water. He seemed to endorse in this decision something that a lot of farmers in the Imperial Valley have long claimed, that really it's the farmers who control the water, because the water is tied to the land, not to the IID. Something the farmers there have pushed for a long time, that really we're the landowners and the water is tied to the land. Therefore, it's really our water, not the IID's water. So that decision's on appeal right now, but if that stands, there are a lot of people who are really worried that sort of imperils the ability of the IID to be part of regional water cutback agreements and to contribute to trying to protect the Colorado River, because it sort of puts them in a position where they just potentially have a lot less leeway to have farmers cut back on their water use. And again, they use so much water. I mean, 3 million acre feet is, it's as much as the states of Arizona and Nevada put together that they have from the Colorado River. So whatever happens in this lawsuit on the appeal potentially has could be a really big deal for everyone who depends on this river, millions of people.
So what was Abadi's solution? Did he have one, and did the judge realize this in his ruling? Or maybe you can kind of give us a peek into the mindset of the judge. You also wrote a separate piece revealing that Abadi offered to drop this lawsuit if his family got a special exemption. So it doesn't sound like Mr. Abadi is like really solution oriented in this thing in terms of a holistic approach.
So that's an interesting thing. Yeah. So the follow-up story I did here is that a couple of years ago, as this lawsuit was really heating up, Abadi made this settlement offer to IID, which I obtained a copy of sort of belatedly. And he said, yes, yeah, you, IID, if you're willing to exempt me and my brother, Jimmy Abadi, who's now the president of the Imperial County Farm Bureau, and their father, Ben Abadi, if you exempt us from this plan that we find draconian, we'll drop our lawsuit, we'll stop challenging it. Everyone else can continue to live under this, but we'll get all the water that we desire, which is certainly interesting. IID rejected that didn't go anywhere. That settlement offer was not accepted at the end, and they kept fighting the lawsuit. I mean, in terms of what Abadi wanted, it's a little bit technical. IID's, this plan for limiting the water use in these shortage years, they wanted to base how much water each farmer, each landowner would get on a combination of two factors, these two things called historical use pattern and also the straight line use pattern, which is basically a fancy way of saying we'll base how much water we give you on a combination of just sort of a standard metric that's applied to everyone, and taking into account how much water you've used historically. And among other things, Mike Abadi argued in this case, well, you can't do this straight line method. The only thing that you should be allowed to take into account is how much water each landowner has used historically. And the judge agreed with that and said, yeah, that's the only thing that you're legally allowed to take into account. And that's what IID is challenging on the appeal right now, in addition to some of this broader language from the judge on who is the ultimate source of control over the water here.
So if Abadi wins this appeal, Sammy, what would it mean potentially in terms of emergency water use? And we know that the Secretary of the Interior, Ryan Zinke, has already proclaimed that these wildfires sweeping the West are not climate change related. And so I would imagine that each water district would kind of be on their own. They wouldn't be necessarily getting support from the federal government at this point in terms of its access to water. Would this limit a water district's ability to distribute their water accordingly in a time of emergency, or is this unique to just the Imperial Valley?
That's a good question. In some ways, it's unique to the Imperial Valley, but there's certainly a worry on IID side, and an argument that I believe they've made that that this could be sort of a precedent-setting issue. And I think it's possible you'll see other water agencies coming in on the side of IID here to support them. To the extent that it was a precedent, it would only apply to other districts that depend on Colorado River water. You're not talking about like farms in the Central Valley in California, Modesto Irrigation District, or Westlands, or some of these Central Valley California agencies. We're talking about irrigation from the Colorado.
So this lawsuit only applies to this one water source. This wouldn't necessarily affect those other farmers in the Central Valley.
That's right. Colorado River water law is its own extremely unique and complicated beast. I mean, the administrative record for this lawsuit has documents that are dating back to like the 1890s. I mean, it's a whole mess of stuff. It potentially, implications in the Colorado River Basin, depending on who you ask. I think if you were to, ask a body or his lawyers or people who are supportive of his case, they would say, no, we're not trying to, mess things up from a regional perspective. IID has always managed the water and, in collaboration with the farmers, and we're going to be partners on this. I think they would have a different perspective on it.
As somebody who's been following this case about as closely as anyone, what do you think the chances of the appeal reversing the decision?
I try not to prognosticate. I think that one thing that I should mention, and this is in the story I wrote about Abadi last month, this judge at the trial court level who made this decision, judge named Brooks Anderholt, a lot of interesting stuff about him. I found in my reporting that he's had various ties in the past from before he was a judge to different members of the Abadi family, and to some of the farmers who are supportive of their cause in this lawsuit. I think there's a question that's been raised about, was Judge Anderholt coming from a real place of impartiality with this decision, or was he someone because of, the perspective that he had and the various ties to members of the Abadi family? Was he inclined to rule in their favor? I also found that he was not the original judge on this case. A couple of judges were switched out. It's unclear to me. I have not been able to determine why it was that the third judge who got on this case and who was in charge of it for a year was switched out for Anderholt, sort of at a critical moment for Abadi and IID. And he then came in and sort of began reversing decisions that had been more favorable to IID. So you look at that and you think, did he make this decision from a place of impartiality? Is it appellate court more likely to overturn it then? I don't really know. I've sort of raised those questions in my story, but I think it's definitely an open question of, where the judge was coming from and how it will play out over a panel of judges who aren't from the Imperial Valley.
Take it when I need fire.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Desert Sun reporter Sammy Roth. So Sammy, you've also been following this story of a bill that would bail out a hydropower plant in your region. Why don't you explain what the importance of the hydropower plant is and what the debate's all about?
Yeah, so this is it's a really interesting project. It's called the Eagle Mountain Pumped Storage Project. This would be built in the desert in California. It's on this land that's sort of surrounded on three sides by Joshua Tree National Park, and it used to be a site for iron mining. And so they've got these big open mining pits that are still sitting there, sort of a disturbed site that would be used as filled up and filled with water to create hydroelectric generation. But what's really interesting about this project from a renewable energy standpoint is that the proposal here is to basically make a giant battery, to have these two open pits, one higher than the other, one lower, where when there's extra solar and wind flooding the grid, as there increasingly is in California, that rather than giving that away for paying other states to take that energy away from us when we don't need it, to basically use it to pump the water uphill from one, the lower pit to the upper pit, functions like a battery in that way, absorbs the energy. And then at night when we've got this evening ramp, people are going home from work, turning the lights and appliances on, and the sun goes down and the solar electricity goes away, you let that water flow back downhill to the lower pit, turn some turbines, generate electricity. Pump storage is the name of the technology. It's not a new idea. It's been around for a while, but this would sort of be at a very big scale and designed to operate in a way that would solve this unique challenge that California has at the moment when it has more and more solar and wind coming online. So that sort of gotten a lot of attention. The flip side of it is that, as I said, it's this land that's right on the doorstep, basically, of Joshua Tree National Park. The company that's proposing this wants to fill these pits with groundwater from the middle of the desert. They want to pump billions of gallons of groundwater and use it for electricity generation. There are people who are worried that this is going to have negative impacts on the national park, because when you're pumping groundwater, aquifers are connected down there. You've had researchers who have said, look, these are the aquifer they'd be pumping is connected to the water beneath the park. We think there would be impact to wildlife, to species. So it's a controversial project. And the developers had a whole lot of trouble getting it built. They have not been able to secure a power purchase contract yet, which they really need before construction is going to begin. And there's this there was this bill that was proposed in the legislature in California that sort of came together at the last minute, in the last month of session. There was a lot of action on it. And this was a bill that would have required state agencies to have this process, but the end result of it would have been that all of the utilities in the state, or many of them, would have been sort of paying in together to contribute to having contracts for large pumped storage hydropower projects like this one. It was sort of a way of saying, California understands that it needs technology like this to meet its renewable energy goals, and so we're all going to come together and figure out a way to pay for it. The bill didn't specify the Eagle Mountain Project by name. The people who supported it were, for the most part, pretty insistent that this was not an Eagle Mountain bill. But the language of the bill made it pretty clear that there were really only two projects that are anywhere close to getting built that this would have really benefited under the short time frame that was in the bill. And one of them is this project called San Vicente in San Diego County, a similar project, and one is this Eagle Mountain project in Riverside County by the National Park. And only Eagle Mountain would have been able to fulfill the terms of the bill on its own. And the chief sponsor of the bill was NextEra Energy Resources, which is a company based in Florida that is one of the, it's a development partner on Eagle Mountain. So it was pretty clear that's what the bill was about. Sort of to my surprise, it didn't pass in the end, even though it seemed to have a lot of support from local representatives. But it was just, it was interesting to see, you know, to see that being pushed as the mechanism to get this, this project built. I mean, the environmental opposition to the bill from groups like Defenders of Wildlife and the Sierra Club and Center for Biological Diversity, National Parks Conservation Association. I mean, that was there was some pretty intense opposition there. Interestingly, you also had opposed to it some trade groups that, energy industry trade groups, people who represented renewables as well, and you know, even some people who represented hydropower developers who were concerned about this sort of picking winners and losers thing of the state coming in and saying, okay, we're going to mandate, you know, this particular type of technology is needed. There were people who had a problem with that.
Maybe you can take a step back, Sammy, and give us an idea of the scale of these hydropower plants we're talking about and how they stack up to some of the larger ones around the country.
Yeah, I mean, so Eagle Mountain would be a 1,300 megawatt project, which I guess is, you know, the size, you know, in terms of just power capacity of what you'd see for a typical, like, maybe a natural gas plant or a coal plant. It's several times larger than, like, the largest solar plant that you've seen in the United States, for instance, just in terms of power capacity. And in California, hydropower is, in terms of electricity generated within the state, it's about a fifth on average, according to the State Energy Commission. And that varies from year to year based on what kinds of water supplies we have and what the snowpack looks like and what the flow on the rivers looks like. This would be a significantly sized project in terms of the pumped storage technology and the amount of renewable energy that, in theory, it would be able to help us integrate. But it would not be, like, game-changing in terms of the amount of hydropower that exists in California or in the country.
So you mentioned how the Sierra Club and other environmental organizations were against Eagle Mountain. Is this something that environmental groups tend to push back against in general, in hydropower electricity? Is this not something that is considered a good alternative for the planet?
That's a really interesting question. California energy politics are pretty surprising sometimes, at least to someone who's you know, hasn't been following it for decades and decades. So California has this renewable energy mandate, the RPS, Renewable Portfolio Standard, and it's, you know, it's 50% by 2030, I guess, although under the bill that Governor Brown just signed, it's going to be 60% by 2030. And large hydropower projects have actually never been counted toward that. You know, you can have solar, wind, geothermal, potentially biomass, I think. Small hydropower projects count, but large hydropower never has. And that really stems from a history of traditional environmentalism being opposed to large-scale hydropower. And there's a long history that informs that, going back to, like, the flooding of Glen Canyon and the creation of Lake Powell, and I mean, in California as well, lots of communities and natural areas that have been flooded and sort of obliterated from what they were before to make way for these large dam and reservoir projects. So that, you know, that informs the continued resistance to it today. And I don't mean to say those arguments are invalid at all. I mean, it's a difficult one to have where you've seen these environmental impacts over time that have been very negative in a lot of ways versus hydropower being carbon-free electric generation. I see it sort of being as a similar debate to the nuclear energy debate, where you have probably there are going to be people who, if they heard me say that, would be really furious at that comparison. But just in the sense that you have sort of traditional environmental opposition to nuclear power for a wide variety of reasons, many of them legitimate, versus the fact that nuclear power is a carbon-free resource and in fact currently the largest carbon-free electricity source in the country, I believe. It's interesting, and in the desert specifically, I mean, there's all sorts of battles over all energy sources when you get into conflict with land use and national parks and preserves and just ecosystems in general. I mean, I've written all sorts of stories about environmental opposition to solar projects and wind projects and, you know, things that you would think that all environmentalists would support, just because when you get into actually putting things on the ground and grading natural land, mining groundwater, you get into really tricky conversations. And many of those conversations are divisive even amongst environmentalists.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Desert Sun reporter Sammy Roth. So speaking of groundwater, Sammy, you recently penned a piece entitled Cadiz Incorporated Wants to Sell Groundwater from the Mojave Desert. Will California Let It Happen? Is this something that happens a lot? Do landowners get to sell their groundwater back to a state? Or is this a unique situation?
That's a good question. It's not unprecedented. It's unique because I think of that it's happening in a desert, not an area that you would traditionally associate with pumping groundwater and using it for stuff. This is a company, Cadiz, that it's unique in that sense, that it's this desert thing. Cadiz owns this land in the Mojave Desert. It's surrounded by the relatively newly created Mojave Trails National Monument, which was established by President Obama. And what they want to do is they want to pump up to 16 billion gallons of groundwater every year and transport it to buyers near the coast, basically. They've got a contract with a water district in Orange County. They're trying to, you know, secure additional contracts. It's become this issue where there are federal roadblocks, potentially, that the Trump administration has been sort of removing for them, or removing in such a way that has helped them. California has looked at various ways that maybe they could block this project. One of those ways was a bill that was in the legislature this year that I wrote about. The bill did not end up passing. So there are, you know, various different fights that are happening that are going to determine whether this project does or doesn't move forward. But at the base of it, yeah, it's a pretty unique concept of pumping groundwater in the desert and selling it to urban areas. I don't know, you know, anything else that's quite like that.
Well, you do great work, and we appreciate your continued coverage of the region. And I think it's important for people outside of California to check out your work as well. Sammy Roth of the Desert Sun, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Always enjoy it, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Chris Joss and Aretha Franklin. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.